Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. And that's a version of Wordy Rapping Hood from a group called Chicks on Speed. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. Not by way of introduction to tonight's guest, because every Sunday night we have someone who comes in and picks the music on the programme. And tonight, it's a poet, Dhiren Ní Gcrithfeá. Dhiren, great to have you here.
Thanks, John. I'm delighted
Ní Gcrithfeá. We were discussing just before you came on about the different types, the way people talk Irish in different parts of the country. So you give me your surname, Ní Gcrithfeá.
So we'd say Ní Gcrithfeá, right. And it's people often think it's translated as Griffin, but it's Griffey.
Griffey, because I've seen that as well, Ní Gcrithfeá.
Yeah. It'd be my name in English would be Dhiren Griffey. And at home in Clare, where I come from, there's a little place called Ballygriffy with a little castle, which my dad is always kind of half convinced we have something maybe to do with that.
Very good. But you were born in Galway, weren't you?
I was born in Galway. But the funny thing about people from Clare is that most of us are born in either Limerick or Galway, because for a long time and now, there's very few people born in Clare. We go to the maternity hospitals in Galway and Limerick.
But were you... Was your association with Galway simply in the maternity hospital?
Yes.
So, okay, all right. It seems like a detail just to confuse people that you put. But you were born in Galway. That's what it says in all your bios.
Yes. But, I was born in Galway.
But you were there for a few days, really.
If that, right. Yeah. Okay. But I'm very fond of Galway, so I don't begrudge it being in my bios.
That's all right. So whereabouts in Clare?
A really tiny parish in Mid Clare called Kilnamona.
Right, and where is that?
It's kind of on the road to Lahinch. Uh-huh. It's maybe halfway-ish between Ennis and Lahinch. A very rural place, a lot of small farms, a very, very beautiful place, which I'm very fond of.
Now, you write your poetry in both English and in Irish.
I do.
And I want to talk about that in some detail a little bit later on. But for now, Dhiren, let's have your first musical choice. And I'm pleased to say... Because I always worry about someone's first musical choice. I'm pleased to say it's Nina Simone. So tell me a little bit about why you picked this as your first.
I love Nina Simone. I'm very interested in her as an artist and in the kind of conflict that we become aware of in who she is and as an artist and how that comes across in her voice and in her performances. With this song that I chose for this evening, Ne Me Quitte Pas, it's a Jacques Brel song, which she sings in French. And I really love the way it's so clearly her voice with her accent delivering someone else's words. And I think as a poet, I'm very interested in that when there's a certain cadence of language and then it's delivered in someone else's voice. How does that friction change the meaning of the words? And the first time that I heard this song, I didn't even really understand a lot of the words. And my French isn't great, so I still don't understand parts of it. But I just think there's such feeling in it and such beauty.
Terrific. Nina Simone, Ne Me Quitte Pas.
Ne me quitte pas.
Ne me quitte pas. Nina Simone there, the choice of Dhiren Ní Gcrithfeá, who's with me in studio tonight, picking all the tunes. Dhiren is a very, very fine poet who writes both in English and in Irish. Let's talk about the Irish for a minute, Dhiren. In what circumstances did you start speaking Irish? Was it in the house? Was it in school? Was it at the Gaeltacht? Was it where?
Well, we didn't have Irish at home ever. We didn't speak Irish at home. My mother's really passionate about languages, and so she wanted to send us to a Gaelscoil. So, that was where I first began to hear Irish. I came home after my very first day at school in a system of immersion education where you walk in the door at 4 years old and you were only spoken Irish too. And I was in an amazing Gaelscoil in Ennis, County Clare, which is still going strong. And when I came home after my first day at school, my mom asked me, how did it go, Dhiren? Was it okay? And I just said, yeah, it was good. But the teacher can only talk rubbish all day long. So that was my first interaction with Irish, the sense of, this person seems nice, but I can't understand a word of it.
And would you recommend that as a way of learning, indeed, any language, that total immersion idea at that age?
I think when we're children, like, I mean, you see it with any little child, they're like a sponge, especially for a language. And they just pick it up so easily when they're totally immersed like that. For me personally, I feel very lucky that I managed to escape without any kind of complex about Irish, simply because it was not even, it didn't even feel like it was taught to me. It was like it was presented to me in such an interesting and normal way that I couldn't help but learn it. So I feel really lucky, John.
Yeah. You see, I think a lot of parents might be uneasy at the thought, even though they might like the idea, they might think that, well, what happens when my kid wants to do their physics homework?
Yeah.
Do you know, and I can't do it in English, never mind in another language.
Yeah.
Do you know, that's often a bit of a barrier there. Is that, should parents worry about that aspect of it?
Ara, I'm all about choice. I think that it's up to each family to decide that kind of thing. I'd have difficulty doing physics homework in English as well as in Irish. But that said, yeah, I took most of my subjects in Irish to Leaving Cert level and then went on to college in English. And I didn't find that transition too tricky. So I think kids kind of roll with the punches to a certain extent and just go with whatever they're given.
Now, when you're a kid of, I don't know, 7, 8, 9, 10, you know, when you're out playing with your friends. And obviously, as a young boy, I might have been playing slightly different games. I don't know if you played Cowboys and Indians or whatever it is. But what was the language of your childhood imagination then, in terms of play and, you know, running around the place?
English, very much English.
Was it? Yeah.
English was always my primary language, my first language, and English is my mother tongue. So, like, yeah, when I was playing, it was all English. I was a real bookish child, and I was reading all the novels I was reading as a child were all in English. Our home life was all in English. The radio, the telly, everything I was encountering outside of school was all English. So, yeah, I guess, yeah, English was the number one, but I developed a very deep kind of grow for Irish as well.
It's interesting that you were exclusively in Irish at school, but exclusively in English, or almost exclusively in English, outside of school.
Maybe it seems weird. It doesn't seem weird to me at all, I suppose, because that was just how I grew up and I didn't ever kind of stop to question it.
Okay, your next musical choice.
We
haven't had one in Irish yet, but we're waiting.
Well, as I'm saying, most of my life is in English. So the next choice is a song called Yours. I heard it on the radio. It's much more recent than the Nina Simone song. And I think something that I should say, and which kind of casts a certain light on all my choices, is that as a writer, as a poet, I suppose, particularly, my ear is very important when I'm listening to songs. Long before I ever wrote a poem, I was a real lyrics person, you know. When I had mixtapes, like actual tapes, not CDs, once it got past the part of a song with lyrics, I would fast forward the music bit just to get to the next bit of lyrics. So the words of songs are really important, and I think a lot of my poetic education actually began with songs. And this is a much more modern song, as I said. And lyrically, it's really interesting to me. I can't really articulate why. You'll see when you hear it in a moment. There's the opening line, I think, is something like, got a £20 note rolled up, a little squashed in my pocket. There's something about squashed and pocket there to a poet that's like a little diamond shining out of this song.
Squash it in your pocket.
Yeah, something like that. There's something.
He could have done better. He could have done more with it. Anyway, this is S.G. Lewis, yeah?
Yes.
There you go. S.G. Lewis there. And a track called Yours, which is the choice of Duran the Grifa, who likes a good rhyme, Squashed in Pocket. I refer you to Jimmy Logsdon's very old song, I Got a Rocket in My Pocket.
There you go, I'll have to look it up.
Because your rocket in pocket is a full rhyme.
Yeah.
What's squashed in pocket? It's not even a half rhyme, is it?
You see, I could go on a little riff there
you
on
could.
That, but I think
I'm setting you up.
I think it's there's some strange alchemy in the fabric inside each of those words.
Okay.
I'll leave it at that.
Okay. You say you were always interested in lyrics.
Mm.
Does that ever get in the way of you enjoying a song, if you know what I mean? You must be constantly thinking, oh, that's a good rhyme, or that's clever, oh, that's very good. You know, you're kind of reviewing something as you listen to it.
No, it's not. It doesn't feel like that at all for me, actually. I think it's just whatever way my brain is wired. Even as a child, I loved listening to the radio and I would just absorb all the lyrics, and there was no sense, and there isn't still for me, of analysis or developing an understanding. It was literally just take in all these words and know them off by heart. And there was no sense of trying. Like, I remember describing this to someone before and they're like, so you listen to a song over and over again till you know all the lyrics by heart. And I'm like, no, it's like a compulsion. I can't help exposing myself to the same song over and over again till it lives inside me.
Mm.
So it's a bit strange, but yeah, even as a kid, I was really like that. Just love lyrics.
When did you first come across a song where you might have thought, ah, no, this is something else. This is on a higher plane.
Well, there's so many songs I came across as a child, and that experience would have been inextricably intertwined for me with listening to the radio. So there was no sense of me choosing or someone else choosing what I was getting to listen to. So, like, I mean, I used to listen to Clare FM, our local radio station, a lot. And I really enjoyed a lot of the kind of country and Irish, the lyrics of that.
Yeah.
Also, like, when it would come to more pop music and that kind of thing, the first song that thumps out at me when I think of myself as a child is Radio Gaga by Queen.
Right.
That was just amazing. It blew my mind. And I must have been very young, I'd say, when I was hearing that first. But yeah, from the start, music was just a really important part of my life.
You see, you're supposed to say, well, I first heard Joni Mitchell, or I first heard Leonard Cohen, or, you know, do you know what I mean? Those are the sorts of people that poets will usually tell you they found as friends in popular music. Those sorts of people.
Not Clare FM,
not
no.
Clare
you
FM.
Don't get other people quoting Clare
well,
FM.
Well, you know, it's hard to beat the poet in a good George Jones song or a Merle Haggard song. Or indeed, the best of them all, a Hank Williams song.
Well, yeah, there's no shortage of Hank Williams on Clare FM, so I have them to thank for a lot of my musical education.
Yeah, definitely poetry there. And what about the notion that, you know, a song like Tutti Frutti by Little Richard is a very fine piece of poetry. What babaloo babalab bamba. But you know what I mean?
I can see how people might make that argument, but it wouldn't have ever done it for me, I'm afraid.
All right, you're too young. All right, you're too young. There's nothing I can do for
no,
you whatsoever.
I'm a lost cause.
Your next musical choice is Jeff Buckley.
Yeah, like, you see, I suppose with a lot of the songs that I've chosen this evening, I started college at 17 in 1998, and I was there for quite a while after that. And so a lot of my...
So what does that mean, you were there for quite a while?
The first course that I started, I didn't succeed in finishing it, so I changed and did another course. So I started on my adventures in college by wanting very badly to become a dentist. And very quickly realised that I wasn't to become a dentist.
In what circumstances does anybody want to become a dentist?
Yeah, I really wanted to become a dentist. And actually, what's funny, and I suppose we only find this as we go through life, that sometimes your failures are what make you more than your successes. And I wouldn't swap the year I did in dentistry for the world. The year that I did, I was 17, say 17 and a few months going into it. It's such an important part of your life. And so I was in with the same class that would have been doing pre-med in UCC. So that was the year where in your studies in anatomy, you dissect a human body. So that was what I went into at 17. And I learned so much. And it was a really formative experience for me, the studies of anatomy in particular. And it's something I carry with me, and I think about it all the time still, to the point where I've actually donated my own body to medical science. So to the outside, it might look like that year was a failure, but to me, it was the makings of me.
Wow. It's great material, you know, it's great material to have in the background when you're a writer.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it's one thing writing about the human body, but when you've actually dissected one.
Yeah, I was very, very fortunate. Wow. Yeah.
So when you decided that dentistry wasn't for you, where did you go after that?
I was really lucky also with my parents, because as much as I had bought into the dream of dentistry, they knew from the start that this was a terrible plan, and they tried to convince me at every turn, you know, would you reconsider maybe doing an arts degree there, and you know, and I sure, being a teenager, I was going to do the opposite of what they were sensibly suggesting. So when I realised that dentistry wasn't for me, they were thrilled. And so I changed and I did a degree course in applied psychology with a minor in English, which stood to me a lot more, I think. And then I trained as a primary school teacher and I taught for a good few years and I loved that too.
So. It's an extraordinarily rich background to have, isn't it? Because most people go through university and, you know, they do, you know, one thing and maybe don't even do that with kind of much enthusiasm, really. But to have some medical background, to have psychology and English, that's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, UCC gave me a lot. I was very, very lucky, I think, that I happened onto campus there. In as much with the people that I fell in with, as well as the courses, like I was given a solid education. And I had great crack as well. So
we were about to play Jeff Buckley, weren't we? And I interrupted you to tell me about your dentistry.
Yes, yeah. Well, no, that was actually a good tangent, because it was around the time that I was doing dentistry that I would have gotten really into Jeff Buckley. And like, I mean, 1998, a lot of people would have been the same way in college. You know, it would be more unusual if you would have escaped Jeff Buckley if you were in college in 1998. So, yeah, this is one song. It was hard for me to just pick one from Grace.
Lover, you should have come over.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Jeff Buckley there in Love You Should Have Come Over, the choice of Duren Ní Grefa, who's picking the music tonight on Mystery Train. We were talking there, Duren, how you went to college and the sort of the subjects that you studied and a kind of false starts in one thing and another. That's fair enough. That happens. But how do you feel about your college years looking back? Because I sometimes talk to friends of mine and quite a few of us might admit to the fact that we kind of wasted our time there in lots of ways, you know?
Yeah, you're supposed to waste it, I think.
Well, not in a productive way. You can't waste your time productively, I know.
Yeah.
But there are people who, you know, they talk about their college years and they did this and they did that and they met this wonderful professor who taught, you know, blah, blah, to change their life and all. And I kind of think I don't know what I was doing.
Yeah, I know what I was doing, kind of. A lot of it was like sitting around drinking with a gang of great people and having chats.
But you don't have to go to college to do that.
You definitely don't, no. But like, I mean, if you're looking at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, sitting back chatting about music or something and, you know, having a drink and having a smoke, that I can't imagine that I would have been able to do that if I wasn't. I know since I left college, I have never been able to do it. So I'm glad I had those days.
You should make more of an effort, you know.
Maybe it's ahead for me.
You're not applying yourself.
But I feel like, yeah, if I was sitting down talking to someone and they were saying, oh, I had the most inspiring time in college and talking about amazing lectures and that kind of thing. I feel it was much more of a social kind of a time for me, I suppose. That said, I had some amazing lectures. Now, I slept in for a lot of my lectures, but the ones I went to, there was one lecture I had in film in UCC, which I only did one module of, I think for maybe even just 1 year or 2 years. And the lecture was called Gwenda Young. And it was so deeply formative for me because she would stride into the room and she would speak so passionately about like something that might seem really obscure to a lot of people, like some silent film from decades before. And this just burst me open to a whole new kind of sense of a different type of culture. And she worked all the way up from silent film, like we were talking about film noir and things like that. And just the way that she would analyze each film, the themes and that kind of thing, she was just extraordinary. Like, I'd love to meet her again and just thank her, because she educated me in terms of how I look at film and how I look at any kind of visual media. So I'm glad I didn't sleep in for those lectures.
Yeah, maybe that's all it takes, you know. You might need 3 or 4 years somewhere and one thing happens and that's enough.
Well, there you go, yeah.
And what about in terms of writing? Were you involved in any kind of, you know, poetry group or literary society or any of that kind of stuff?
Nothing. No. I really was just like going to lectures and having fun in college. I didn't write a syllable. I didn't consider myself a writer until I was in like my mid to late 20s. So this point in my life, as close as I would have come to poetry would have been lyrics. Yeah.
Quite right, because a lot of people, and I'm including myself, wrote stuff back then. And we'd been better off in the pub.
Okay.
Talking about football, really. So you're better to leave it and then a little bit later on have a go at it. Let's have your next musical choice.
So my next one is a Four Tops song called Bernadette, and my mom
sounds vaguely religious.
Yeah, very vaguely. My mom would have been really into Motown, and
your mom was into Motown.
Yeah,
that explains it all now.
Do you think so?
You got a cool mom.
I've got a very cool mom. Oh my God, don't start me on that, or we'll be here.
No,
all
I
night.
Do. I want to start you on that. She's into Motown.
She loves Motown, yeah, and she's just got great taste in music. So is my dad. Before I get in trouble, and my dad would have really been into Leonard Cohen. So anyways, Motown, yeah, I wanted to represent this part of my musical taste because I love Motown, and it was really hard again to pick just one song to represent that, but I went for this Four Tops song because Bernadette feels like such an Irish name to me, you know, like in the same way that something like Magella feels real Irish to me. And so I just love in this song you have someone roaring, Bernadette, Bernadette, over and over again. And like, get out of the garden, Bernadette. Get in the house for your dinner now. So this is Bernadette.
The Four Tops. Four Tops and Bernadette, the choice of Dúirnigh Riafa, who's in studio with me tonight picking all the tunes. And where are we? University? You did nothing there either. Okay, 4 years sitting about. and you hadn't written anything.
Nothing.
Had you written even at school something that maybe the teacher might have said, you know, that's really good, I'll put that on the notice board or anything?
I had a lovely English teacher in the tech in Ennis called Mr. Moylan. And he was fantastic. He used to do that thing for weekend homework where you'd have to go away and write a little story, and then on Monday he would sometimes pick one to read out to the class. Now, as a teenager, I was pretty mortified any time he picked mine and read it to the class. But this part of you feels very seen when a teacher chooses to read something you've written out to the class. So, yeah, when I think of, in terms of writing, what kind of teachers were influential, it would be Mr. Moylan, very much so. He was a great teacher. But yeah, in college, no, I would never have considered myself a writer. I never tried to write anything at all in college.
So when did the first poem emerge?
It's kind of a strange story.
Oh, good. We like that.
Yeah. Well, prepare yourself. So I left college, qualified as a teacher and was teaching primary school in a Gaelscoil, and very, very happy, really enjoying teaching and just my daily life of going to work and paying the bills and buying groceries and whatnot. And I had my first child, which I was delighted about, a son. And then my grandfather, who I'd been very close to all my life, was very ill and we knew he was going to pass away. So the whole family gathered here in Dublin to be with him, and I came up with the baby. And when we got the call in the middle of the night, I was in my aunt's house and everyone woke up and was rushing to the hospital to be by his side. But I wasn't able to bring the baby, so it was decided that I should stay at the house. And I was very upset, you know, very, very upset. But I was putting the baby to sleep, so I was lying down next to him, breastfeeding him, and the room was dark. And suddenly lines came to me in Irish, lines of a poem, lines in rhyme. And it was so strange that I felt like this must be something I studied in school or something I read somewhere that is now coming back to me because I'm upset. And it kept very much like what I was saying earlier about how lyrics go round and round my head. It just kept kind of repeating itself on a loop. And when the baby fell asleep, I hopped up and went running around my aunt's house looking for pen and paper and wrote it down and just kind of stared at the page and was puzzling over it. And then another poem came from who knows where, and I wrote that down as well and was just thinking, this is so, so strange. But for whatever reason that happened, and every day after that, I have sat down in front of a blank piece of paper and written something down on it. So it is a strange story and I can't explain it.
Well, did you know it was a poem or was it just words you were hearing? Or
I knew it was a poem because it was there was certain metrics to it and it was in rhyme. And it was a strange poem because it was about nighttime on Clare Island, which is some place I've never been. Yeah, it's very weird. I don't know. I always feel a bit strange when I tell the story because it's like a bit eerie fairy or something. And it's one of those things in life that doesn't really have an explanation.
Well, they come from somewhere, and they come from somewhere quite mysterious, don't they?
They do. You don't know where a poem comes from ever. And oftentimes when I'm looking back on the poems that I'm proudest of myself that I've written, I almost can't remember writing them. I feel like as a writer, you have to almost make yourself invisible and become a conduit for the work. Like something comes through you and you have to, your job is to get out of its way. It feels a very physical process to me, you know, and I suppose not to trouble over it or not to fret over it is a big thing for me, just to make myself present in front of the blank page and try and get my own busy head out of the way and let the writing come through me.
Now, when you say, you know, a conduit and it comes through you and it comes from somewhere, do you think those first lines came from your grandfather?
I honestly don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I suppose I'm the type of person where I'm not afraid of saying I don't know. I could tell that story in five different ways with five different morals to it, you know what I mean? Mm. But I choose to tell it as it feels to me as a human being, which is that this is a strange thing that happened and I don't know why or where it came from.
But what about the bit you said? You said you have to get out of its way, right? But most people write poetry, or what clicks it off, I think, with most people is something very personal. It's actually about their own life, people they know, their own family, their own experiences, their own whatever it is. So how do you get out of the way of yourself as such?
I can only talk about my own experience. I don't know how it works for anyone else. But what I find with me is that sometimes I'll want to write a poem and I'll sit down and I can write a poem about a specific subject from my life. But the best poems that come for me are the ones where I succeed in getting out of the way and where I'm not consciously sitting down with a subject wanting to write something, where I can kind of, like I say, make myself invisible. That's my best superpower, when I can do that, when I can get rid of me and just let the words come. They're the best ones. And I find, here's my only writing tip that I can ever give anyone, I find for me the best time for me to write is right before I fall asleep. I say to myself what it is that I'm grappling with, whatever it is at the time that I'm trying to struggle with in terms of my writing. And as I close my eyes, it's there with me somehow. And sometimes you can get a really good line will just come. And I jot it down immediately. So that kind of a thing, like that's an important part of my process, the sense of you're short-circuiting your sense of self, because you're just in that moment right before you fall asleep, you're leaving yourself open to something completely different. So that's my only writing tip, John.
I've heard, I've written it down. I've heard some singers have told me quite seriously that when they sing, they feel they're connected in to everything that's been sung before, to all the singers that have existed before them. Like this kind of network out there in this space somewhere.
I mean, I can absolutely relate to that. Particularly, I suppose, being an Irish woman. I'm going to get on my hobby horse now. But yeah, no, it's a very particular experience being an Irish woman, and particularly being an Irish woman who writes, because there's a great network of us writing at the moment. So whenever I'm sitting down writing, I'm very conscious of all the amazing women that are writing around me, but also the sense of women who have written in the past, and the sense of women's literature from the past that we still have and we're very lucky to have. I've been writing a lot about Queen Earthy Lyra, which was composed by Eileen Dubhny Connell in the 18th century. And we're so lucky to have that because it was carried in women's bodies. It was passed from mouth to mouth as a keen. So it was passed from woman's body to woman's body to woman's body until it was finally written down and committed to paper. So whenever I'm writing, I feel a very strong sense of those women of the past, women who, not only the women who composed the poetries that we have, the Irish poetries that we have of Irish women, but also the women who carried those poems so that they could reach us. And it feels an exercise in humanity, I suppose, you know, a lot of the time, that you're allowing yourself to become a conduit for the work, to let it come through you, but that it's also an honouring of the people who've gone before. When I stand up in public and say a poem, it feels extremely powerful how a poem will thunder through your body, come out, lift it out through your throat and be presented to people and have a physical effect on people there. Like I remember once reading a poem by Kathleen Maud, a wonderful poet who died very young. She was in her early 40s. And I remember reading one of her poems to an audience, and the sense of her voice and what she had composed coming up through my body, and then looking down at the audience, and a lot of them were weeping. Like, that's a moment of great power. Mm. And we're very lucky, I think, in Ireland to have a consideration of the vitality and the sense of literature as a living thing that we can carry to each other. And I think a lot of that is in our roots are so recent of things being oral, you know. At home, what we'd call going on court, going calling to the neighbour, sit down and tell a story. Mm. And I do think that that's very close to us as writers in Ireland today.
Your next choice, Duran, is Nick Cave. Nick Cave. We'll talk about Nick in a minute.
Okay.
Nick Cave there, and Far From Me from the album The Boatman's Call. Very fine album. The choice of Duran Ní Gréifeá, who's with me in studio. You're a Nick Cave fan, Duran, are you?
I am a little bit.
Now, why a little bit? Because most people are utterly obsessed with Nick Cave. Where's the resistance?
I'm utterly obsessed with him, but I'm so obsessed with lyrics that I go round and round and round the same couple of albums all the time rather than listening to everything. Like, literally just obsessively the same things over and over again. And with this particular song, I had it on my, like, listening to music these days, you know, in modern times. I had it stored on my phone, and when I went into hospital to have my youngest child, my daughter, it was quite a traumatic experience, and she was brought down to the neonatal ICU. And that was the first time for me, after having had a baby, that I was on my own without the baby next to me. And I was listening to this album just over and over and over again compulsively, but particularly this song. And so anytime I listen to it now, like, the lyrics of it are so not what I was going through at all, but there's some deeper level at which it really spoke to me. And every time I hear the line that goes way across some bleak and fishless sea, for me, what I see in my mind's eye when I hear that line is the sense of being up on one of the top floors of the maternity hospital and knowing that my daughter was like four or five floors below me and that I couldn't reach her. And so that sense of that image becomes almost like an ocean to me, you know. So that song is really important to me for that time. And we came through that time, and I can listen to it now without crying. Surprise, surprise.
No, I mean, I don't know what state you were in at the time, but it's curious that you didn't reach for your own words, if you know what I mean. Did you write about that situation? Do poets write about traumatic situations while they're in them?
I don't know about other poets, but I am writing constantly, all the time. And again, everything happened very fast in that situation. So I didn't have notebooks or anything like that with me. So I was tapping into email drafts and emailing things to myself constantly while I was in hospital. And right after I gave birth to her in the recovery room, I wrote the bones of a poem called Lines Written on Spinal Morphine, when I really was on spinal morphine. And
I know that poem, and it's amazing. Yeah.
It's a strange poem, and I think the presence of the spinal morphine is definitely in the lines of the poem and in the weird rhymes in it. But
see, it might seem extraordinary to any woman listening that you would have anything on your mind after having a baby, you know, and that you would be anything of that nature, that you actually be starting to write poems.
Yeah.
Because I'll tell you one thing, if I had sat down beside the bed and started to write a poem, I'd have been beaten around the head. Quite rightly, I suspect.
Yeah. Well, that's a fair enough point. But I suppose my brain has become so used to trying to find little bits of art in my day-to-day life that's like a release valve for me, you know. Like if I was to go through a day like that was that hard, and not have any part of my brain that was like throwing up ideas or half line of a poem that I might use at some future point, then I would be getting to boiling point very fast. Like I need to be able to get something down, or I start to panic. And it almost keeps me calm writing something. So, yeah, I would have been in a worse scenario if I hadn't written something down, I think.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more musical choices from Duran Ní Gaoithfeá. And this is Mystery Train, RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special. My guest tonight, picking all the tunes, is the poet Duran Ní Gaoithfeá. And it's great so far, great. And I'm looking at the list. There's a lot more good stuff to come. Duran, just before that break there, we were talking about how you, in even extreme situations, you will be, the poetry will come and you'll write down lines and you'll work on something, and, you know, even in a traumatic situation like that. And yet poetry is not, I think, as some people seem to think it is, it's not therapy. You know, poetry is not some kind of, it can be good for you, obviously, and it could, you could be in a real mess if you don't do it. But it's not, that's not what it's for specifically, though, is it? Therapy.
I teach creative writing a lot, and I see a lot of scenarios in which people come to poetry wanting to use it as therapy to delve into something that has happened to them, whether something of joy or something of trauma or something of grief, and to use poetry as a tool in order to help them to exercise or to control those experiences. And I have all respect for that. I think that we...
Does it produce good work, therapy?
In that scenario where it's a creative writing situation and someone is coming to it as a tool in order to help them to cope with something, if they can come away from it feeling that it has helped them, then it is successful.
Yeah.
Whether or not an audience will come to the poem and judge it as successful or not is kind of tangential to that.
Sure.
But I think for us as writers and as poets and as artists, the sense of using your art form as therapy is something people talk about a lot. And I try not to get too hung up in that, because I feel very much like whatever works, works.
Mm.
And if you're in a situation as a writer, as an artist, where you are working through something which has happened to you and that your art form feels a little like therapy, I don't see anything wrong with that. And I feel sometimes for an audience that being invited into an intimate space created by an artist or a writer in which they explore something, that can be very cathartic for people as well. So Yeah, I suppose you could argue both sides of it, John, like anything, you know. But for me, I would feel very strongly about letting people do in their lines and in their poems and in their art and in their books what feels right to them.
In your own case, because as you say, you do creative writing and you have to deal with all sorts of people who come with different approaches to things. But for yourself, what are you hoping to achieve? What's a successful poem for you?
Because poetry is such a mysterious thing, it's hard to answer that without getting a little bit airy-fairy. But I think for me, when I take a step back from the actual nuts and bolts of trying to write on a daily basis, and when I try and look and get a greater sense of the landscape of what I'm trying to achieve, one of the big things that's important for me is a sense of honouring the past in terms of like the women who have come before me. I kind of feel a sense of I want to do them proud. That's a big part of the fire that's been lit under me, you know. I feel a real sense of loyalty and a sense of being just one very temporary person in a long line of women who have tried to make good art, and I want to be one of them trying to make good art.
Okay, next musical choice. Oh, Reckless.
Yes.
I know this one.
Yeah, that's because I heard it on your show. This is a perfect example of one of those situations where I hear a song and I really like the way that the language moves in it and the lyrics and the way that it's delivered, and I get totally addicted to it, and it just is on repeat in my house all the time.
So. This is Simon Raymond's album Lost Horizons and different singers, different performers on the tracks, and it's Ghost Poet in this case.
Yeah, very suitable name.
Ghost Poet, indeed. Lost Horizons there, the guest vocalist in that case, Ghost Poet, a song called Reckless, the choice of Dúran Ní Gcrích, who's with me in studio picking all the tunes tonight. Dúran, you were talking there earlier about how, you know, you kind of feel a sense of all the women that write at the moment, and you're connected with that, and also the women that went before. That suggests a sense of, or maybe it doesn't actually, but does it suggest a sense of a public position when you're a poet? How do you approach that side of things, that you write something very privately, but it goes public to a greater or lesser degree? Do you have to think about that? Particularly, as you said, if you feel connected into a network of people.
Yeah, I suppose when I'm saying that, I feel much more connected to the sense of women who have been here before me and are no longer around. But in terms of a public audience and presenting work in public, that's something over the past couple of years that has become really important to me, because I've started to see how it's not just like a chance for you to read your work. It's a chance for you to inhabit the work and to speak it to an audience. And there's a really profound and special relationship you build with each audience, I feel like. And it's a source of great joy for me now, being invited to come and talk to an audience and to read all my weird poems. But I always realise as I'm picking my poems that I'm going to perform, like, all my poems are just like on a continuum of sex and violence the whole time. So I think maybe sometimes the audiences can be a bit startled. But yeah, there's a really special relationship there with any writer standing in front of an audience. And what I have found is the more I've grown to respect that, the more I get from that experience and the more that they get from it too. So.
Well, does that in any way, and again, everybody's different, change the dynamic? Because you're writing a poem, you know, in the dark, in your house, by yourself.
Yeah.
With no sense that anybody's ever going to see it or it's ever going to turn into anything.
Yeah.
And then the next thing, you know, you're performing it to a group of people, some of whom are hanging on your every word. Mm-hmm. So it gets, you end up in a kind of a strange position with something that was originally very, very private.
Yeah, I suppose you know what you're getting into as well. You know, like when in terms of the writing process, your main loyalty when you're actually writing and making the poem is loyalty to the poem itself. So you're just trying to let the poem become itself, what it really is. And some of that, like often on a first draft or something, when I'm going back and editing it again, I'm just finding the pieces where Dirin has come in, you know, where my voice is there all over it and kind of wrecking it. And I have to just kind of like take
why,
out.
Why shouldn't Dirin come in? It's Dirin's poem.
Because
about something that's happened to Dirin.
Yeah, but not always. But because the poem has to be the poem. It doesn't have to be like, I don't have to be there in every single line. The poem has to be able to stand on its own two legs when it's printed on a piece of A4 page and just left someplace. The poem has to be able to stand on its own. Mm-hmm. So like a cabinet maker, like someone who would have like done wood turning and made like a little cabinet or something. That's what a poem feels like to me, the sense of getting into something, trying to make it as sturdy as you can and trying to make it as ornate as you can in a way that's true to the piece of furniture that it is. You know, mm. not just doing loads of mad curlicues all over just because you like doing them.
Yeah.
And just letting it be what it is. But yeah, I love performing to an audience now. It's something I've really grown to enjoy.
Well, here's the thing. Some poets are not very good readers of their work at all. Don't do their work justice when they read, and some of them wish they wouldn't, and it doesn't work so well. Some of them are so good as performers. There's a slight hint of suspicion, actually, that this poem was written with a view to being performed, if you know what I mean. That there were jokes put in here, there were lines put in here, there were beats put in here, deliberately,
yeah,
to entertain an audience, to make them laugh.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with making people laugh, but that's stand-up comedy.
Yeah, and that's an interesting distinction, but I suppose that's to each his own to a certain extent. Like, if the poet himself or herself, if that's part of their artistic project, if they're making things to be delivered to an audience, then creating a piece like what you just described there may be a very successful piece for them because it may be achieving exactly what they want to achieve in the poem.
Yeah, but what about if you're playing to the crowd rather than playing to the poem?
You see, again, I can only talk for myself. And
you're
for
so
me,
diplomatic.
My first loyalty is playing to the poem. And I think we need to be able to talk to a crowd as well. If a poem is a good poem, it will work on the page and it will work read aloud to people. Think of kids' books. Think of like a small child's book, a picture book, or think of The Gruffalo or something like that. Mm. That will work as an artistic project when you read it on the page. When you read it aloud to a gaggle of 30 kids, that will work equally successfully. So, I mean, we tend to be quite precious about poetry. You know, is this good enough? By what parameters do we mean? I think that what's most important is that the poet works hard on their work and is proud of it, and that the reader or the listener takes something from it.
Okay. Next musical choice. Ah.
Yeah.
Will Oldham, Bonnie Prince Billy.
Oh, I love this song so much, John. This is I See a Darkness. And again, I suppose we're kind of back in college in a way, because when I started to listen to this album first, I was in college and I just fell for it wildly and madly and would listen to it on repeat and repeat and repeat. And we've gone from mixtapes at this point to those unwieldy little Discmans that we used to have to hike around the place. And my copy, my CD of this album was so scratched that I used to have to borrow it from someone else to listen to this song without it skipping. So I See a Darkness.
Silencio there, Ibrahim Ferrer, Amara Portuondo, and before that, Bonnie Prince Billy and I See a Darkness. Two choices there from Dirin Ní Gcríofa, who's with me in studio picking all the tracks. Well, I can't complain about either of those.
Mm-hmm.
Extraordinary, extraordinary. Will Oldham or Bonnie Prince Billy, great lyricist if anybody doesn't know him. Really.
Fantastic.
Worth a look.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
You're about to play a song now from Elvis Costello.
Yes.
Called I Want You.
Yeah.
It's a real big song. It was on an album called Blood and Chocolate, and it's a big highlight of his live gigs to this day. And it's shattering in terms of the power of it.
Yeah.
Especially live, right?
Yeah.
If I said to you, there isn't a poet on the planet can come close to a good song like this, what would you say?
Depends on the poem. Yeah. what I love about this, and what is so difficult to get across in poetry, sometimes, what I love about this is the muscularity of the lyrics. The song is so strong in every line. There's such weird power behind it. And I'm a sucker for this song because, like with my poems, anything that has that combination of desire and darkness, I'm just sold. So,
he's your man for that.
Oh my God. So yeah, I love this. I love it. It's so weird and it's so unsettling and strange. And it's just really interesting lyrically, but also in terms of the song itself, it just blows my mind.
I Want You, Elvis Costello.
Oh, my baby, baby.
Elvis Costello there, and I Want You. What a song. What a song. Devastating song. Anyway, Duran Ní Gcrích picking the music tonight. Time for some more. I want to ask you about, in terms of the language thing, Duran, because you've published poetry in Irish and you've published poetry in English. How does that work? Does the line just happen to come to you in one language or another that prompts a poem, and that's how it...
Yeah, exactly. Like, each poem that I write, as I start to get that sense that there's a poem coming or a poem on its way, as the impulse arrives, I already kind of know which language it'll be in. So I translate the Irish poems into English myself. But with the English poems, I don't translate them into Irish. I just leave them as they are. Mm. I suppose we're made by the society that we grow up in. So there's that sense for me that always when I was growing up, as much as English was the language of my daily life and of home, that Irish was the language of school. And school for me, with the school that I went to, was very strong culturally in terms of Irish literature, in terms of Irish music, Irish dance, that kind of thing. So for me, I suppose, as I started to make an effort to write poems, I had the sense that there were both of these languages surrounding me. Now, when I started to write at the start, I only wrote in Irish for a long time. So my first two books were in Irish and my third was in English. And the only reason I came around to writing poems in English was because I forced myself to start trying to translate my Irish poems to English so that I could present them to an audience who might not have Irish.
And do you feel equally capable in both languages in terms of this? Now, this is I know you're equally capable in both languages, but what I mean is in terms of nuance and so on. I remember translating something once, or trying to translate something from Irish. The translation was okay, but I had no idea if I had the right nuance, if I had missed a bit of wordplay, a little trick, a little game, you know, things like that. So those are the things that would worry someone writing in another language. Are they actually getting it close to what they really mean?
Yeah. I suppose for me, a lot of people would maybe look at me as a writer and think that because I'm a bilingual writer, that my Irish poems have a certain level of artistry and that my English poems have the same level of artistry. But in fact, because English is my first language, I'd say I find it a lot... I think with...
Do you want to say this in Irish?
I think with the English poems, because it's my first language, often I have a lot more nuance to play with.
Yeah.
Because Irish is my second language, I will sometimes toil a lot more over a single line than something that will come very quickly to me in English, in the tone and the register that I want it to. Whereas with Irish, I feel I'm very careful, and they sometimes, my Irish poems to me, although I know I'm very, very hard on my poems in general, but the Irish poems to me sometimes feel a little bit jagged around the edges because it's not my first language, you know.
And what about, you know, does the magic happen equally in both, and happy accidents and strange connections and odd rhymes that just happen? It happens,
yes,
in both, yeah.
Yeah, it does, it does. And
I mean the mysterious stuff.
Yeah, the mysterious stuff happens in both languages. The process feels very similar in both languages. The only thing that's different really is the sense that I feel very careful when I'm writing in Irish, that I want to get it right, that I want to be true to the poem. And that sense that I was talking about earlier of making myself invisible can be a bit trickier in Irish, when sometimes I need to consult a dictionary to find exactly how I want to say something. So it's much more automatic when I'm writing in English. And it's interesting for me. I do feel the two languages are nourishing to me as a writer. And language is so malleable anyway. I mean, even when you look at English, how we're using English these days, how much the language is changing in terms of how we use it, not just in literature, but in the media, and even coming up to Brexit and Trump and everything like that, how language became strange and estranged itself from us.
Brian Friel used to say it's all about language.
Yeah, it's all
everything
about language, but language is shifting under us now, you know, in a way that maybe I had assumed a lot of my life that language, and by language, I suppose I'm referring to English here, was a static thing and it was steady, and that language was going to carry through your meaning, the original intention of your meaning. But what I feel very much looking at, especially how language is used politically at the moment, is how much that has changed, you know. What we used to call facts aren't facts anymore, you know.
1984.
There you go.
It's all there.
There you go.
Your next choice is, this is going to be your penultimate choice, isn't it? Your penultimate choice, which is an English word, which means, which means your second last choice.
There you go.
Okay, what are you going to have? Arcade Fire.
So I'm, again, with the lyrics, you know, Arcade Fire, I've enjoyed all of their albums from a lyrical point of view. And the song that I've picked is from Neon Bible. It's My Body is a Cage. And actually feeds into what we were talking about there, because there's some lines in it that say, I'm living in an age that calls darkness light. Though my language is dead, still the shapes fill my head. And that feels very kind of profound for me in the political landscape that we're living in at the moment, but also in terms of the care with which I feel we should treat Irish. You know, our language isn't dead yet, but if we keep going the way we're going, it might die. So
on that note. Arcade Fire there, the choice of Dúirne Ní Griffa, who's with me in studio picking the tunes, My Body is a Cage. And we'll have time for one more. But before we go, Dúirne, I want to ask you a little bit about, more than most, you seem to have done quite a lot of collaboration. Again, that interests me because poetry is a solitary act, clearly. And, you know, is it just for company? Is it just for... is it the creative impulse that, you know, you think you can add to what you've done by working with somebody else?
I think like poetry is a solitary art, but also there's a sense that it's really good as a companion. So like, you know, if you compose a poem, it can work really well with several different art forms. And what I've found is that it always deepens and nourishes the poem. There's never been a situation where I've engaged in a collaboration and gone like, well, that made the poem worse. You know, it's always been something that I've learned from and grown from. And I suppose as a writer, probably one of my biggest drives is the sense that I'm always learning. You know, I'm always flinging myself in the deep end of trying something new. And collaboration really nourishes that impulse in me, the sense of like, yeah, sure, we'll try it and see what happens.
But what are the essential ingredients in a collaboration for you? Because it's not enough. it seems to me it's not enough that you read your poem while somebody plays keyboards in the background.
No.
That's not a collaboration.
Yeah, no, no. What I have found really interesting is working with people that I really admire who are very dedicated to their own art form. So, for example, I've collaborated a lot in the past with Lynd Buckley, who's an amazing composer. Mm-hmm. I admire her so much. And so the way that we have worked is that sometimes we've performed together. So I will show her some poems. She'll come up with some music. Sometimes she'll compose something to go with the poems. And then the sense of performance and the chemistry and the friction between the poems and the music is really interesting. Also, we've done projects where I've made little films of poems, and then we've had her music as well. So that's one sense in which it works. Then, like, I mean, I've done projects like a really amazing project I did recently with the artist Alice Maher, who's just someone I admire so deeply. I love her work and I love her work ethic and who she is. And I was delighted when she agreed to do a project with me. And that was a very interesting collaboration because it involved doing a research trip to a very drafty and cold abbey in Tipperary to do a rubbing of a mermaid on the wall there in Kilcooley Abbey. A lot of dialogue back and forth, and, you know, she would send me certain articles and writings and chapters from books and discussions. And then I took away one of the rubbings that we had done of the mermaid in the abbey, stuck it on my wall and wrote a series of poems as the mermaid was kind of looking down on me, you know. So that was a really interesting collaboration as well. And that book will be published by Salvage Press.
So these are situations where, if you weren't together, it wouldn't happen. You know, nothing's going to happen if you don't come together. But it could be no more than, I mean, that sounds like just two people having a conversation and then doing something.
Yeah, but I suppose there's a conversation and then doing something, but there's the sense of allowing two different art forms to infect each other. Mm. So for me, that's something really interesting. If someone gives you the germ of something and then you're developing it into something else. And sometimes it's even almost the sense of dialogue, and especially because now with computers and whatnot, I mean, a lot of things that we would have had to have meetings for before, we can communicate very quickly, very easily. And you've the sense when you're back and forth with someone that they're in the room with you and you're bouncing things off them.
And what about film?
What about film?
You've done some film collaborative stuff.
That's
a technical term. You've done some stuff.
I have. What I find is that I love poetry so much, and I feel that one of my roles as a poet is opening the doors all the time, just opening all the doors and all the windows in the house of poetry and letting people come and have a look. So it's a big ask, especially as an Irish language poet, where people have certain, which I really understand, ingrained attitudes often from school, where they're quite wary of Irish language literature. And I find that sometimes if you can let them in through the back door, they really enjoy it, unbeknownst to themselves. So
before they know what's happening.
Yeah, take them unawares. But I feel that film for me has been a great... It's like the key of the back door of the house, you know. I use film and I'll write a poem, and if I make a little film of it, and if I have different people who collaborate with me or help me to do music or that kind of thing, it's really great, because then you put it out there and you see that people who may not come to a book of Irish language poems may still come and watch a film on YouTube, which is just like 2 minutes long, but they have, unbeknownst to themselves, absorbed an Irish language poem.
Great stuff. Darren, thanks a million for coming in, picking all these great tracks and being so open and insightful about the poetry,
about the work.
It's great to have you in here. And
I picked a belter to go out on.
I'm glad. You now you know how it works. You've got a belter to go out on. And I notice it's Violent Femmes.
Yeah,
I think we've lived the same life in some ways, certainly musically. Violent Femmes added up. Darren Ní Grifa, thanks a million. Good night.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.